Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Due diligence on Classic Business is brought to you by Deal Leaders International, leaders in mergers and acquisitions. Well, in a world obsessed with fiber, today's guest has quietly been building the wireless backbone that keeps South Africa's digital economy ticking along, particularly when the fiber guys drop the ball. VioConnect may not be a household name, but chances are it's the reason your data center is still online, your backup connection is still humming, or your ISP is that final kilometer covered. Founded by a team of telecoms veterans and now backed by private equity firm Vuna Partners, VioConnect is using licensed microwave spectrum and last mile ingenuity to deliver fast and affordable bandwidth where fiber fears go and fear to tread, I think, sometimes. I sat down with Kevin Taskus, managing director and one of the co-founders, to talk about the realities of telco infrastructure in the country, landing a major partnership with one of the country's top telcos, and what it's like scaling a connectivity business with a long customer take-on cycle and even longer investment horizons. This is what he had to say. Well, Kevin, it's great to have you on Classic Business. Firstly, let's dial it all the way back. Where does the VioConnect story begin?
Yes.
What gap were you solving when you set out to build this business?
Jeez, Michael, thank you for having me. I think it's been a real interesting journey of solutions-based solving for customers that really drove us into the space. If I go back to the early dial-up days, where kind of originated in the early ISP days, where no one had any access to this wonderful thing called the internet, we really cut our teeth on understanding what it is that people needed and trying to get modems into PCs to get them dialed up and connected. And obviously the big onslaught of trying to get us connected to this wonderful thing called the internet was an interesting space. And we had one particular early customer in the early days that pioneered the fiber to the home scenario, which was a company called Smart Village. And Smart Village had this crazy idea of saying, well, why can't we connect a lot of consumers sitting in blocks of units where they can connect up and we can have one nice network. And then from there, we can backhaul them out to the internet and we can offer so-called fiber to the home, which back then I think was more copper to the home than anything. So we started off with this particular customer and our problem was not really connecting the customers. The problem was as soon as we got to the meet me room or the central room at these estates, we couldn't get anything more than 2 megabits per second back to the data center. And then we've got 600, 700, 800 people sitting in these communities trying to squeeze themselves into 2 megabits per second, which was the best Telkom could offer in those days on their Diginet lines. We were faced with a conundrum. What do we do? So we sat around together with a customer and we were brainstorming what the objects of. And unfortunately, in those days, we had the problem that Telkom was the only provider that we were allowed to connect with and we couldn't traverse a public road. That was the law.
Yeah.
Until Altec came to our rescue and took them to court and opened up the whole VANS license operators and began to get licenses to be able to do this. And then Chris and I sat down one day. This was Chris van der Walt from Smart Village. And we said, well, why don't we think about doing something wirelessly? So the next day, my partner Wayne and myself put on our shoes, walked up a mountain, found a tower, did a deal with the tower manager, and we brought some kit in from Radwin, and we built our first wireless network. I think in the first estate in that time was an estate called Jackal Creek in Johannesburg. I'm sure you know the name.
Yeah.
I think. And we built our first wireless network, and I think we got 9 megabits per second.
And what year? I'm fascinated. What year was that? Because, I mean, you've been at this for 30 years now.
Yeah, 30 years now. So that must have been around 2008, 2009.
Right.
Where we built our first wireless network that took us from Internet Solutions Data Center in Rosebank. We jumped across to Northcliff Hill, from there across to Ruderkranz and down to Jackal Creek. And we built this network and we were managed to go from 2 meg to 9 meg and we have a very happy customer. And we began to really partner with Smart Village to take this network into different places and different estates until we got to a place where we realized, you know what, this is not just good for consumers. This is actually very good for business too. And we then began to break this up into small pieces and larger networks so that we could actually provide this as a last mile offering to customers where fiber wasn't, or where fiber was taking its time to get off the ground.
Yeah.
And that really pushed us into a phase of kind of, well, where do we take this business and how do we scale this business in a way that actually works? And we were contending with smaller wireless ISPs in the day that were also building networks because there was just such a huge demand for bandwidth. So it was a very exciting day. It was rolling up your sleeves, making it happen. Smart Village then bought Vodacom Gated Solutions, which was an interesting one. And they had a portfolio of networks down and estates down in the Cape. And Chris came to me and said, Kev, we need some networks in the Cape. Are you keen? I said, of course, we're keen. Chris, I think they had 6 or 7 estates in the Cape Town CBD area. So Anne and I got on a plane, flew into Cape Town, started knocking on doors of different landlords to secure some high sites, and we built those networks as well. And that just was kind of the growth phase of what we were called back then. The VO part was something called virtual office. We had this idea in the late 90s of creating a virtual office for our customers. Everything was going to be virtual, and we were going to have them. Until we started getting calls where people wanted virtual office space, and we thought, oh, dear, this is not really what we are. And then we changed it into VO Connect to be a connectivity medium. It's quite funny. But, yeah, I think it was the whole pioneering stage of how do we bring this bandwidth back to people that desperately need it.
Wireless
was such a wonderful way of cutting, through – a lot of difficult spaces to make it work. And the technology really worked well,
Yeah, I mean, and the VO name was really ahead of its time. If you think virtual
it
office
was,
pre-COVID.
Suddenly now it's not so far away. Yeah?
Exactly. Looking back to those first few developments, what worked, what didn't, and kind of what kept you going through the early phases of developing and growing the business?
I think the key for us there was the excitement of seeing bandwidth. You know, what made those networks come alive was the growth in the bandwidth demand and being able to supply that service. I mean, we cut our teeth on different kit. We cut our teeth on different vendors, trying to think and make things work. And I think that's what drove us as a team, was to know there was a solution, know that we could put it into place, and know that it worked. And we were kind of pushing the boundaries a lot of the time on some of this kit where we were, kind of making these microticks work and making this work. And we kind of got to a phase where we said, well, how do we take this now to the next level? How do we now really kind of make this a proper B2B offering that actually is something that we can put an SLA to, something that we can drive home as as a product that we can actually deliver? And the key one there for us was Spectrum. Without Spectrum, we couldn't now push the barriers to say, can we escalate the speed levels that we need to get to, and can we guarantee them? And unfortunately, in that unlicensed space, there was just too much competition and too much noise there to be able to deliver it.
And I think one of the historic challenges, certainly for wireless internet service providers or WISPs, was that they operate predominantly in that 5.8 gigahertz ISM band, which I mean, that can get quite congested in densely populated areas. Yeah. How did you get hold of Spectrum in those early days?
Well, that was the difficult part. So obviously, in those days, we were just really big MNOs and large corporate telcos that had access to Spectrum. So what we did was I would always jump onto ICASA's website and kind of look at if they had this kind of spreadsheet that they would update on a quarterly basis of who had Spectrum and who didn't have Spectrum. And I don't know if you can remember in the early days, Centec had a broadband offering that they were going to do. I think you could get 128 kilobits per second.
Yes.
I mean, do you remember that? Centec had that offering they were going to do and launch. And it
through InfraCo, I think it was also.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Correct. Absolutely right. So what happened was I jumped onto that website the one night and had a look at it. And it said there, specifically in this particular frequency we're looking at in point to multipoint, is that Centec had returned the spectrum. And I said, right, let's see. Let's get an application into ICASA and see if the merit's there. And if they take it, we put the application in. They came back and they said, yep, Centec has returned the spectrum. You're welcome to apply. So I said, okay. We couldn't afford then to go national on the spectrum. So we said, well, can we apply for certain regional areas? And Devold Corral, the head of spectrum at ICASA, was very willing to help us and to get us going. And then we started with Gauteng. We then broke into the Western Cape. And now we sit with regional licenses in most metros in SA on 10.5. gigahertz, which is a really long and great spectrum that takes distances up to sort of 10 to 15 kilometers in length from point to multipoint. And then recently, about 3 years, 4 years ago, we applied for 28 gigahertz spectrum, which gives us large capacity point to multipoint networks that take us up to 200, 300 megabits per second. So the wireless industry technology is growing at such a rate, and we're doing amazing things in the 80 gigahertz space. You know, we launched a customer last week that needed 1 gigabits per second as a failover for a large corporate in Centurion, and those speeds take us up to 10 gigabits per second. So it's just amazing to see where wireless has come from and what it's still capable of doing.
Yeah, no, even a listener, someone who works in radio, we monitor that radio spectrum all the time after Classic FM went into business rescue. We're still looking to maybe relaunch Classic FM in Johannesburg when some spectrum becomes available. But, I mean, that's a particular bandwidth. Let's come back to those early days and how you initially funded the growth of the business. Did you bootstrap initially?
We bootstrapped. We absolutely bootstrapped. We just took our working capital that we had with us. We went into some serious, you know, we took our chances where we had to. We funded it even on our home bonds, Wayne and I. We took the money out of our bonds. Wow. And we also had a very interesting relationship with the then Broadlink. I don't know if you remember Broadlink.
Mm-hmm.
So Broadlink were based in Sandton, and they were in a phase of upgrading their network to their next sort of network release, and they had a lot of kits sitting in their warehouse that they were trying to get rid of. And we kind of put our hands up in the early days and said, "Oh, we'll help you with a bit of that secondhand kit." And this was really in the 5.8 days in unlicensed space, and that really helped us. And they were quite key in helping us to get a lot of that early kit out that was a little low cost to capital back then, and that allowed us to kind of grow our network. And then as soon as we got some larger corporates on our books, we began to expand into sort of bigger investments into that business. But it was really bootstrapping and using every bit of working capital that we could was really refunded into the business. And I think with infrastructure companies, it's really what we do. You know, a lot of your profits go back into building next generation networks.
Yeah, and having a real belief in what you're doing, because you know when you've got that kind of skin in the game and you're on the hook for it, boy, there's a real alignment between outcomes and effort there as well. Then you start landing the big customers and you realize this is growing and you start scaling. Take me through those scale years and how that helped refine the business until where we are today.
Well, I can remember in 2015, we got our approval from ICASA on our 10.5 license. And we then had to find a radio that could work in 10.5 gigahertz. And we were very fortunate to find a vendor that really helped us in those early days. But we picked up a customer through Dimension Data called Pick and Pay. Pick and Pay was rolling out a good large network, and Dimension Data really needed help with the back then internet solutions that needed help to get to a lot of these customers where all they really wanted was a 10 megabits or a 5 megabits per second service alongside other networks that were taking just too long to install. Fiber networks were in the growth phase and build phase back then. And to get resilience into a lot of these retail stores, it was very difficult because a single point of failure and Pick and Pay's whole point of sale system would go offline. It was really needed that wireless failover, even primary. And, you know, having that many stores and to deliver that type of service, we really partnered really well there. And that kind of took us into a big build, quick rollout phase, getting into places that we never even dreamed were possible. And it kind of gave us we had this attitude in the business that there was nothing we couldn't get to because it's wireless. There was no high side too far away. There was nothing too difficult to get to. And I think that was the motto we had inside the organization was, we always saw the glass half full. We were always optimistic that we would find something, negotiate with somebody to get on some high space to be able to get to a customer. And I think our customers loved that in terms of saying, well, if somebody can't do it, at least we can phone VO and they can get us out of the shtuck here and make it work. And I think that was the ethos and the hunger inside the business of saying, yo, you know, there's no business too small, too big, too this or too anything that we can't help. And I think that's what we loved about it. Our passion was to get our network spread out, to be able to enhance and do things that were very difficult back then, which we actually thrived on and loved. And I think there were a lot of fantastic stories of other WISPs as well and wireless ISPs in the day that really had the same sort of hunger in a lot of different regions. And it was this filled the gap, you know, between nothing and to where we are today on a lot of the larger fiber networks, etc. You know,
it's an attitude that I picked up in Alan Knott Craig Sr.'s story around building out Vodacom. Those early days where he writes in his book about driving around, you know, hopping out the car and saying, right, we need to put a tower here, and doing a deal on the spot with the checkbook with a business owner or a property owner right there.
Literally.
Quite literally. So, but it's also, you know, an industry that does have long customer take-on cycles. So what's your secret weapon for staying patient and persuasive?
Probably the relationship. I think relationship drives who we are and what we do. I think you said earlier in your intro, we've just taken over a large telco's network on their wireless side. And our relationship that it took us, the length of time it took us to get to that point was 2 or 3 or 4 years in the making of just who we are. We 25 years down in this business, we're still here. We're here to do business for the long term. And we're relationship guys. We like to pick up the phone, talk directly to people. You know, it's always about getting around the table, having discussions, keeping things alive through relationship. And we're a big driver of culture of that in our businesses.
Yeah.
Who are we talking to? And I think relationship is key, especially when you've got difficult moments of networks. You know, the neat thing about the networking world is we don't sleep. Networks never sleep. They're 24/7, 365 operations. You know, we don't get to the end of 5 o'clock at the end of the day and say, great guys, we can put our pants down and go home.
Yeah.
Networks are running through the night. Businesses are relying on us to be able to keep their doors open. And that's really what we see, is we see ourselves as the anchor, as the platform for people to do business with. And without networks, solid networks and solid ISPs and solid network operators, your business gets left in the lurch.
Which telco is that deal with?
Via Connect, call us. We'll help you.
but I mean, you laugh, Kevin. You've reached a scale here that is really impressive. I mean, 1,500 migrated customers is a huge inflection point. So being a relationship business, how do you absorb that kind of operational scale up without compromising on the relationships and the quality?
I think if we look at our staff, we're back our staff. We make sure that the culture internally is one of optimism. It's one of doing your work and being proud of the work that you do. You know, it's easy to say we can take on 1,500 customers, but when we realize that these customers are in places that are very remote, very difficult to get to, or very concentrated in some areas, it takes a lot of work, after hours work. Guys are working long hours to get things up, cutting over customers at midnight, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the culture internally of looking after staff, making sure we kind of have that same optimism and life in the staff that we have, they bring the magic out in our networks. Without them, we couldn't be where we are today. And, you know, I take my hat off to some of our guys that are in Buc-ee's on mountains and, you know, working in places where there's, you know, think about theft on towers, and we're up against it all the time. You know, we just had a recent incident on Simonsberg in Cape Town, where the guys arrived. You know, networks go down, and the whole site was burnt to the ground. You know, just because they couldn't break in or access, and you're faced with difficult circumstances, tricky places that they got to get themselves into. And if it isn't for staff that go the extra mile, I don't think we'd be where we are. Right now as well. So
very interesting. You know, because I mean, you're talking about a team of engineers and strategists and network specialists, but it speaks to that kind of internal culture that you've built, that you must be quite proud of. And clearly this is very intentional in how you've grown the business.
We've just put in place about 3 or 4 years ago a new MD, Justin McKenzie, and he's second generation family in this business, which is nice to see. I have my son, Samuel Taskus, working in the business in sales, second generation. So we have this culture of family. We've got Corné de Villiers, who used to be the CEO of Herotel, interestingly enough, who's also in this business. And if we just look at the culture of the way we work together and the culture of family, and that taking what we do seriously, but also taking what we do as this is what we do. This is something that we love to do. This is something that we see opportunity in. We got a call yesterday, I think it was, for another business that's saying, can you please come and help us in our wireless space? So we really feel ourselves that this is a niche thing that we do. We do it really well. And we're happy to be that niche. We don't want to be all things to all people.
Yeah.
Because then I feel our product sets just get too wide. And then we end up, you know, the good old saying of being a mile wide but an inch deep. We don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I think what we do is we do it well. And yes, we have our issues. We have our problems. But there's nothing a problem where a customer can't pick up the phone and say, hey, Kev, I think you guys have got an issue here. Can you step in? And that's what we do. The phone's always on and we step in and we make it happen.
So given that, I mean, let's talk then about the partnership with Vuna Partners and bringing in private equity, because often when you talk about that kind of culture, it's founder-led, entrepreneurial, you know, second-generation family members coming in.
Mm-hmm.
It's your baby. And that now you're going to bring in, you know, these financial partners. There's a reputation around private equity. Firstly, what was the catalyst for bringing in outside capital?
Well, if I take our relationship with Vuna and specifically with Sia, I met Sia, I think it was about 2018. So this is now 7 years ago that I first met Sia. And I met Sia when we were doing quite a lot of business with some other wireless ISPs that he was involved with back then. And we just seemed to kick off a relationship where when we met, it was just we had this sort of similar heart. And the first interactions that I had with Sia was one of, gee, this is a guy I can trust. This is a guy who has a little bit more than the standard sort of equity partner or person that you're speaking to. It wasn't just about the deal. It wasn't just about what can we do or where it is. He had heart.
Yeah.
And I think when I do business with people, it's about heart. It's about, do you have an understanding of who we are and do you understand the culture? And I think Sia was really that kind of person. We kept in touch, and then we got to a phase where we were like, okay, now this business is kind of moving on to its next phase. How do we do that, and who do we do that with, and how do we partner with the right empowerment partners, et cetera, et cetera? And the first guy that I called was Sia. And I said, Sia, you know, is it possible to sit down and have a chat? He said, absolutely. And we didn't do it overnight. It took us a better part of 18 months to 2 years to get to that phase. And Sia was a real gentleman.
Yeah.
You know, he would give us space. He gave us the ability to say, this is what we can do. This is where we, Sia, this is where we go. And this is what we need to get to. And just the interaction that we had with him was so pleasant. And the advice and the interpretation of what his views were in the business were fantastic. So we were really delighted to do business with Sia, and he's such a great, humble partner in what we do. And I think he has the same optimism and enthusiasm in our business for where we're going. So we were really excited with Sia. I really enjoy working with him.
And I'm sure many weekends spent ribbing each other over the Shark Stormers results as well. It's been a good battle over the years. Knowing Sia, he loves his rugby, and you know, you're Stellenbosch based. So I'm pretty sure you're a Stormer. We won't talk about what they
absolutely
did against Glasgow recently. But has having a financial partner changed how you operate day to day at all? Maybe to phrase it differently, if you look at the value that they've added beyond the capital, has there been any unexpected maybe moments in how you think about governance or reporting or strategic planning, which is really into their wheelhouse?
Absolutely. I think it's also what it does is it creates a couple of boundaries that are good for us, you know, us entrepreneurs and the way we run out and do things. I think we do it now with a lot more perspective and realism. And I think that's the great part about having, you know, structured board meets that we do. You know, we came out of a board meet last week where we sat together and, you know, really looked at the business from a different perspective. And I think that's the perspective Vuna brings to our field their field of expertise comes into our world. And we suddenly get a greater picture of what the capabilities are going forward and what do those financial outcomes look like. And are we actually pushing our limits in terms of what we're capable of.
Yeah.
Even since they've arrived, I can see even on our operational side, we have We have taken our ops just has become far more refined. We've got far more visibility on a lot of numbers that we didn't have before. And I think that's the financial due diligence that Avuno has brought to the table, that maybe before, because of our entrepreneurial relationship side business, sometimes that's not as important. They now bring that important phase. And I think that also gives us a great base. Where we go from here is that that becomes attractive going forward, because we have both sets of that a seesaw balanced, which I think is really good. And that's what I enjoy with Sia and Katlego and working with his team, is that when you come into the room, we know this is, we're doing business here. You know, we've got big plans and we're going to execute these plans. And I think that keeps us on track. He keeps us on track. And I enjoy it. I really do. It's been a very different phase from a, you know, I'm always called the techie, you know, you're the techie that came in from nothing and, you know, built this business from your garage. And yeah, we are. And I think what Vuna does is that just brings that sort of maturity into our business now, which I really admire.
Yeah. And I think important, as you say, when you hit a growth inflection point and you scale up, that you're not scaling to fail. And often you need a lot of those. They talk in the tech space about people, processes, and technology, but you need those processes in place as well. When you look at the future, what are you most excited about when it comes to the 5G spectrum and the licensed frequency band opportunities that you hold in a market like South Africa where, I mean, let's face it, we still have this huge digital divide. You know, I was recently at the IT Web Security Summit. CISOs are thinking a lot about how do they secure their endpoints in a world where deep fakes and AI are creating new threat actors. Mm-hmm. But we're also in a country that needs better access for education, for services in rural areas. There's so much almost.
It's huge. It's massive. And what I love about wireless is that it gives you access to places that are very difficult or very expensive to get to if you don't have it. And that's what excites us about some of our new vendors and kit that we're working on and the new spaces that we can push into. We have this new phase that Cornet brought into the business called Wireless 2.0. And what does Wireless 2.0 look like in our future? And what I love about Wireless 2.0 is it takes the culmination and combination of many different frequencies and puts it together to form something very special. So in our recent relationship with Liquid Telecoms, we've partnered with Liquid now to be able to be in a position where we've migrated their wireless network onto the VO network. And we've also entrenched ourselves by making use of the Liquid backbone in terms of their fiber capacity and fiber reach that they have throughout the country. Wireless 2.0 says Liquid has fiber in, I'll give you an example that we had the other day. They have fiber in the Durance in the Western Cape. Very unreached place and area. We quickly make an assumption that there's a tower in that particular place that they're connected to. We put up wireless kit that enhances a particular ISP in that area, and suddenly you've got growth. We go into an area like Polokwane. We go into an area like we're busy doing on the southern parts of the Kruger National Park. And with Wireless 2.0, we can use a combination of spectrums for long distance, short distance, high bandwidth, low bandwidth, that gives everybody the ability to be able to buy what they need, but also know that they can get service for what they need. And that brings the endpoint into the discussion of what is that endpoint to every user. Do we have a big SD-WAN rollout right now? Yes, we do. Why? Because people need assurances and SLA uptime.
Yeah.
So we have a fiber network that fails. What do we do when that fiber network fails? Do we have wireless backup? Yes, we do. Do we have LTE backup? Yes, we do. Do we have new spectrums coming down the line that can actually give us larger broadband access for lower costs? Yes, we do. And I think that's the pioneering spirit of telcos, and specifically what we do is how can we make that happen for people on the ground at those particular places and give them what they need. We're looking with Liquid now in the Western Cape to rolling out a lot of new of the up-and-coming customers in places that are very difficult to get to and very marginal places. And it's exciting. You've got a great relationship and working relationship there that says, yes, you know, we're going to help each other and we're going to help the end user.
Yeah, and it's about resilience.
Keep that perspective.
Yeah, you know, as much as it's about new connections, it's also about providing resilience to existing connections. Mm. And I think we've realized through COVID that if you don't have connectivity, you know, it really is the lifeblood of an organization now. You just can't operate in the modern economy without that.
Can't.
So, you know, it becomes absolutely critical. Yeah.
And I think the rural reach and the wonderful work that current wireless ISPs are doing in areas where you'd think that there's nothing, and you'll look onto a hill or you'll look onto something high and there's a small infrastructure, there's a dish on there, and some guy is supplying a farmer who needs something in that area or is supplying a little business that's running there, and their networks are working. They do it well. They look after their customers. And, you know, sometimes I feel like the new entrants into the market that are pushing their way in, that are going to, you know, look at taking out some of those little wireless pieces. Don't underestimate the wireless ISP in some of these little dorps and little places that are doing a fantastic job. You know, they are enablers of people that have needed stuff for so many years. We must support them. We must, you know, we must help them because they're the guys that did the hard work to pioneer a lot of those areas. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great.
Just as we ending up our time, I mean, if you were to advise, I know Operation Vulindlela at a national level is working on digital, and a big part of that is digital transformation and digital communications. What would you like to see from government to help businesses, to help the private sector and entrepreneurs better serve rural areas, rural communities, and bridge that digital divide that we have in the country?
What would I want to see from government? I think the government has a role to play to invite operators into areas. You know, I think the partnerships that we can have with smaller entrepreneurs in little areas, I think is a huge opportunity. If we can take and train and involve young entrepreneurs in some of these smaller places, they're the guys on the ground that can get people connected. They're the guys on the ground that can help connect whoever it needs. They can train the people on the ground. They can connect little applications on the ground. And if we can promote that entrepreneurial spirit into local rural operators, I think we have a success story to talk about. And instead of driving that from top business down, can top business from the government perspective say, listen, let's involve those on the ground at these local levels. And if we do that, we expand so much quicker. We involve those so much faster. And then we begin to bring local entrepreneurship into these areas, which I think is desperate right now. We're desperate for that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
if we can keep the cost down and we can keep the, you know, do that at the right level, I think if government can push that and invite those discussions in and promote that, especially from ICASA's perspective or from talking to big business and saying, big business, listen, how can we enable those on the ground to be able to do those things? And I think that's exciting for me.
Yeah, I mean, just think about AI in every public school. You've got access to the best teachers in the world that can help address some of the capacity constraints there.
Wonderful.
And just not really developing our human capital. What advice would you give to other founders in infrastructure-heavy sectors looking to raise capital and grow a business, given what you've experienced over the last 30-odd years?
Sure, Michael.
Don't do it.
If you're willing to do some long days, long years, lose a bit of gray hair, oh, man. Look, I think it's the passion for what you do. If you have a passion for connectivity, or if you have a passion for something that you do, you'll always push the limits and the boundaries for what that is.
Yeah.
And the passion for what we do and the love that we have just to see something happen and work and the solution actually be successful, I think, is what drives us to be able to push more into it. I think three quarters of most of what we do is not really about the success of a financial success, although Sia would see it differently. But it's more about the passion that we have for this industry. And if you have a passion for your industry, or if you have a passion for what you do, then you'll stop at nothing to get that through and to make it work.
Yeah.
And I think that the success behind every good successful businessman or entrepreneur is seeing progress in what you do. And as soon as you reach one milestone, you want to hit the next milestone. When you get through those milestones, you look back and you go, gee, what did we actually do? When we were busy with it, it was frightening. It was difficult. It was hard. There were some hard times. But then when you look back on the success and you just say, thank you, Lord, for helping us through these things and giving us the wisdom to be able to make good connections and good calls and putting the right people in the right place. And I don't know how we did it financially, by hook or by crook, we got through. But it's about the passion that you have for what you do.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's exciting.
Passion, listen, everything is hard. You speak to any entrepreneur in any sector, they've gone through hard periods, but it's the passion that gets you up through and keeps you going through the hard moments. And I think that is an absolutely critical ingredient. Kevin Taskins, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
That, you know, often success doesn't always have to come with buzzwords and initial billion brand valuation. Sometimes it's just built quietly, meter by meter. Everything that you've done, Lysis, Spectrum,
Keep
Steel Mask, Stubborn Resilience. There we go. Great chatting to you here on Classic Business. Take care.
Michael, thank you. Much appreciated.
Due Diligence on Classic Business is brought to you by Deal Leaders, partnering with you. For the next episode of Due Diligence, listen to Classic Business next Tuesday around 20 to 7, brought to you by Deal Leaders International.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.